My name is Velocity Child. Welcome to Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. This is a special storytelling edition tonight. I will be sharing with you a variety of tales. To start with, I'm going to open with a special love of mine, Dr. Seuss. A unique story he wrote called The Seven Lady Godivas. And here we go. History has treated no name so shabbily as the name Godiva. Today, Lady Godiva brings to mind a shameful picture. A big blonde nude trotting around the town on a horse. In the background of this picture, there are always peeping Toms, an illicit snooper with questionable intentions. The author feels that the time has come to speak. There was not one, there were seven Lady Godivas. And their nakedness actually was not a thing of shame. So far as Peeping Tom is concerned, he never really peeped. Peeping was merely the old family name. And Tom and his six brothers bore it with pride. A beautiful story of love, honor, and scientific achievement has too long been gathering dust in the archives. Love, Dr. Seuss, Coventry, 1939. Chapter 1. Old Lord Godiva. On the 15th of May, in the year 1066, Lord Godiva, Earl of All Coventry, summoned his daughters to appear before him in the Great North Hall of the Castle Godiva. For a long, silent moment, he regarded them proudly, for the seven daughters of Lord Godiva had brains. Nowhere, he thought with satisfaction, could there be a group of young ladies that wasted less time upon frivol and froth. No fluffy-duff primping, no feather, no fuss. They were simply themselves and chose not to disguise it. "Girls," announced Lord Godiva, "today I leave for the Battle of Hastings." "And," he added calmly, "I am going by horseback." "Horseback!" The sisters looked nervously from one to another. In that day in England, the horse was not taken lightly. True, Lord Godiva had been experimenting with these animals for years, but the horse remained a mystery, unbroken in spirit, a contrary beast full of wiles and surprises. "Come, come," chided Lord Godiva, rattling his spurs. "Don't be so old-fashioned. This is 1066. Definitely, I shall attend the battle on horseback." Lord Godiva had spoken. His metal feet clanked as he led his daughters to the courtyard. Their bare feet followed, cold on the cobbles. Waiting and saddled stood Nathan, his war horse. From the eye holes in his hood gear, he watched the group approaching. "Nice horse," smiled Lord Godiva, holding out a lump of sugar. Nathan ignored it. He looked sullen and foreboding. Lord Godiva put the sugar back in the pocket of his armor. He climbed into the saddle and aimed for the drawbridge. Nathan started off in a sideways sort of trot. "Good luck," shouted the girls, waving their handkerchiefs. "To victory!" shouted Lord Godiva, brandishing his broadsword. but everyone must have shouted too loud. Nathan reared, his front knees dipped low, and his hind knees flew high. He pitched Lord Godiva, Earl of all Coventry, spurs over breastplate, off on his helm. By the time his daughters reached him, the old warrior was dead. Like any normal daughters, the Godiva sisters wept. Then they stiffened their shoulders and faced the facts. Their father was gone, destroyed by a horse. The girls were left with a grim obligation. Horses must be studied and charted, made safe for posterity. Seven hands clasped over Lord Godiva's remains. Seven tongues spoke. Seven pledges were uttered. "I swear," swore each, "I shall not wed until I have brought to the light of this world some new and worthy horse truth of benefit to man." It was an oath of heroic proportions. How long this horse truth quest might take was something no Godiva knew. But each one knew she was sad and sick at heart. Each one was in love. Each one betrothed. That night, when the seven peeping brothers came to court, their ladies, all doors of the castle, Godiva, were bolted. Nailed to every door was a copy of the oath. Very sadly, Peeping Tom, Peeping Dick, Peeping Harry, Peeping Jack, Peeping Drext, Peeping Sylvester, and Peeping Fraglerheisen each dropped his bouquet into the moat. Then they all went home to wait. Chapter 2, Teeny Godiva. The next morning, Hedwig awoke in the chill of dawn. "I am the eldest," she thought as she brushed her teeth. "I must manage these oaths in a systematic way." She cut sheets of parchment and stitched them together. She bound them with care in a cover of rawhide. To the top of this volume, she hitched a bronze chain. Then she knocked at her sister's doors. "Follow me," said Hedwig. Just that and nothing more. Six solemn Godivas followed Hedwig to the stables. Hedwig hung the volume just outside the stable door. Then she showed them the contents, exactly seven pages, and each one a blank. "Somewhere there are horse truths," Hedwig said briefly. "Each of us must find out one and inscribe it on her page. An oath has been sworn. That oath shall be kept. So long as your page remains empty of horse truth, so shall your life remain empty of love." A terrible silence filled the stable courtyard. The mind of each Godiva was far away with her peeping. Hedwig stamped her foot. "Enough with this wishy-washy schoolgirl mourning." "To horse," she shouted, and plunged into the barn. A clatter of hoofbeats rang through the yard. Over the drawbridge, they made for the fields. Through the fens and the bracken, through the thistle and the gorse, through moorland and marshland, the great quest was on. But Teeny Godiva was not with the others, left behind, left alone, left unnoticed. Teeny was too fat for any horse to carry. She sat down on a small pile of oats and wept. Her prospects added up badly indeed. No horse truth, no peeping, no nothing. By and by, the oats became very uncomfortable. Teeny got up and went into the stable. Dejected, she wandered past stall after stall. Out in the sunlight, her sisters were trotting, galloping, cantering, earning their love right. Here it was hot, and the horses dozed drearily. No cooperation, she sighed, as she trudged down the aisles. At Teeny's elbow, a lazy mare yawned, an enormous crude yawn, uncouth and ill-mannered. Teeny stalked on. Then she sensed something strange, and she stopped and looked back. The yawn, to her amazement, was still going on. Wider and wider the beast's jaw stretched open, the yawn of all yawns. It blossomed, it bloomed from gape stage to gape stage, from gape stage to gape gop. At last, it reached its zenith and froze there ajar. Teeny had never seen anything like it. I say, puzzled Teeny, maybe this isn't a yawn after all. The horse almost seemed to be inviting inspection. She stopped up to the mare. It stood still, obliging. And she stepped up quite close and peered down its windpipe. When her sisters returned to the castle for lunch, they found Teeny in bed. From the crown of her head to the scruff of her neck, she was swathed deep in bandages, ointment, and lint. "Nose gone," she said simply. "Teeny, poor Teeny," gasped her horrified sisters. "Poor Teeny, nothing." A radiant smile filtered up through the gauze. "You know that mare Uncle Ethelbert gave us last Christmas? With the help of the darling, I filled in my page." "A horse truth?" "A great one," said Teeny. "Don't ever look a gift horse in the mouth." In spite of the fact she was in no shape for kissing, Teeny Godiva married Peeping Tom that very night. Chapter 3. Dorcas J. Godiva. In their bachelor household each morning, the Peepings were in high, helpful spirits. A horse truth had been consummated on the very first day. "At this rate," rejoiced the brothers, "we'll all be married within the week." And at breakfast in the castle, Arabella, Mitzi, Lulu, Gussie, and Hedwig Godiva simply bubbled with cheer. The horse truth quest was going to be easy. But Dorcas J. Godiva sat cool and unemotional. "It was a fluke, girls," she declared. "Teeny was just plain lucky. And if you're planning to loaf around the barns and let the horses do the thinking, I warn you, girls, right here and now, you'll never win your peepings. Research, believe me, is our one and only answer." "What research?" Lulu, puzzled, looked up from her herring. "Research," explained Dorcas, "is the concentrated examination and correlation of the multitudinous phenomena coexistent in some specific field of activity. For my field, I have selected the study of horse-drawn vehicular transportation. Her sisters were not interested, leaving them to loll and lounge in the stables, waiting for horse truths to drop into their laps. The analytical Godiva plunged into her research. In buggies and trumbles and sulkies and chaises, she rumbled through the highways and byways of Coventry. Each day, a different vehicle, each day, the selfsame horse, and she watched his every action with a sharp and eager eye. But Fidwick, her horse, was a hard nut to crack. Stolid and placid, he pulled without emotion. His truths, if he should have such, he kept to himself. My wagons, thought Dorcas, must be made more provoking. Fidwick was smug and needed a jolt. So she rigged up a gig she called Wagon Superior. She constructed the wagon part purposely low so that every fourth step, when his hindquarters rose, the board slapped a rhythmic tattoo on his rump. Dorcas was right. Fidwick's smugness was visibly shaken. In his eyes, she detected a flicker of protest. She determined to pique him a little bit more. She rigged up a gig called Wagon Inferior. Fidwick objected with ill humor and scorn. He had just about become accustomed to the wagon up on top, and now the wretched woman had slung one down below, down between his knees. So he had to trot wide in a disgraceful, undignified, bow-legged gait. His mood at the end of the day was just foul. Dorcas was elated. In the smoldering depths of his mounting distemper, something was brewing, and it might be a horse truth. So she went a step further. This gig she rigged up, she called Wagon Anterior. Never, from a horse's point of view, had a vehicle been constructed with less consideration. The whole crazy business was backside, too. Giddy-app, called Dorcas, as offensively as possible. That giddy-app for Fidwick was the very last straw. He saw red. He saw orange. He saw green, blue, and violet. Something in Fidwick virtually exploded. In the greatest horse and tree conflict that Coventry has ever known, Dorcas J. Godiva discovered horse truth number two. Don't, was its substance. Put the cart before the horse. Her wedding, however, was postponed for some time. It took more than 5 months to remove the splinters to make the lady of research reasonably safe for Peeping Dick. Chapter 4. Arabella Godiva. If ever a horse had reason to take to drink, it was Brutus. Arabella was wearing the poor devil down. So anxious was she to wed Peeping Harry that even while she slept, she worked the horse like mad. Nightly, she would sleepwalk down to the stables, and all night she would sleep trot over the hills. Brutus, of course, cracked under the strain. Somehow he had learned that the fermented mash at the bottom of the silo had a soothing, consoling effect upon his troubles. So, whenever he got the chance, he'd tip hoof stealthily around to the silo and indulge himself in a little quiet lapping. In no time at all, Brutus had degenerated into a drunken bum. Look at him! Look at him!" cried Arabella one morning. Brutus was suffering the most extravagant hangover ever experienced by man or beast. He lay sprawled on his rumpled straw, his eyes bloodshot, his nostrils a-quiver. He addled head-swam, devoid of all horse sense. As a colleague in science, he was no help at all. "He's a drunk," said Arabella, "and I want another horse." But Hedwig spoke up sharply. "Arabella, I've known Brutus since he was a colt, so I. What Brutus is today, you yourself have made him. You'll stick to him through thick and thin. Come along, girls." Arabella's sister stalked out of the barn. Arabella frowned at the old besotted Brutus. Through this dissipated hulk lay her only road to freedom. Brutus, she realized, would have to be reformed. "Oh, for goodness sake," she snapped. "Make a horse of yourself." She tugged at his halter. Slowly, painfully, he staggered to his feet. He swayed there, weaving on four legs of rubber. Through the open window, he caught a glimpse of the silo. His murky eyes brightened. "Oh, no, you don't," shouted Arabella, and she dragged the poor creature straight out to the pump. "Pump stuff," shuddered Brutus. "I'll die before I touch it." He did. Arabella phrased her horse truth in the oath book very neatly. "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." Then, underneath, she scribbled in a big, conceited scrawl, "By the time you old maids read this, I'll be Mrs. Peeping Harry." Chapter 5. Mitzi Godiva. "Mitzi, my sweet," wrote able-bodied seaman Peeping Jack from his perch in the crow's nest of the bouncing Queen Maeve, plying the trade routes of the Ultima Thule. "It's 7 years now. How about that horse truth? Your true love, Peeping Jack." He sealed the letter with a kiss and posted it the next week in the port of Bru Na Boin. From Bru Na Boin to Queen Silin to Brineg Lag to Thwilon Thrain, by sea skiff post and oxdrawn dray, the love note came to Coventry. It reached Mitzi in the stable on Midsummer's Day, that dreadfully hot August of 1073. As she read the brisk, fresh words, Mitzi was transported. The stables, the horses, all drifted away. She heard the shrill pipe of seagulls, felt the tang of salty spray. The surge of mighty rollers roared in her ears. She thought of lobsters and clams. Mitzi Godiva was a true sailor's sweetheart. The vision faded. Once more to her nostrils came the smell of mildewed straw. Mitzi Godiva was back in the barn. "Horses! Stupid, hay-munching beasts of dry land! If only they were seahorses, that would be different." "Seahorses," mused Mitzi. "A glorious idea. I shall go at the horse from the nautical angle." In a giddy frenzy of excitement, she plunged into the problems of equestrian aquatics. She swam horses across ponds, and she swam them into harbors. She dived them from the chalk cliffs and fed them on seaweed. When her horses had become thoroughly at home in the water, Mitzi was ready for her great experiment. She designed and constructed a horse-propelled rowboat, and she named it the Peeping Jack, in honor of her sweetheart. It was a beautiful thing, far ahead of its time, and generally speaking, it worked like a charm. It was not the lack of seahorse power that made the craft a failure. It was the hammer, hammer, hammer on the oak hard treads. When every voyage was halfway through, the horse came down with hoof burn. The Peeping Jack was a one-way cruiser. Mitzi sank it and faced the whole problem anew. One blustery day in the following March, Mitzi slipped moorings and headed up the river in the Peeping Jack too. Mitzi at the tiller, Clover on the treadmill, and Dapples, the spare mare, perched high in the poop. Against a stiff swirling current, Clover pushed on. In 3 hours, she clocked off a good 13 knots. Then she stopped. It was hoof burn. "Dapples," commanded Mitzi, smiling and confident. "Take your trick on the treadmill. Climb down and go forward." It was a wonderful scheme, and it ought to have worked. And it would have, if Dapples had followed Mitzi's instructions. But instead of passing sideways according to plan, Dapples attempted to go over Clover. At most disastrous piece of horseplay ensued. The wreckage of the Peeping Jack II was swept down the river. No one ever saw what happened to the horses, but her sisters saw Mitzi as she bounced down the rapids, clinging to some flotsam, headed hell-bent for sea. "Here's one for the book," her voice came back in anguish. "Never change horses in the middle of the stream." Several days later, she was picked up off Guernsey, oddly enough, by the bouncing Queen Maeve, and the sailor who saved her was good Peeping Jack. They were married at sea by the captain. Chapter 6. Lulu Godiva. On the 16th of April, 1078, Lulu Godiva was kicked by her horse, fairly and squarely smacked in the hayloft. In the hay, to her amazement, she found Peeping Drexel's diamond stick pin. He had lost it there, a trysting on a previous occasion. Thus Lulu discovered that horseshoes are lucky. Lulu Godiva made a beeline for the oath book. She jotted down her horse truth and left the place forever. Chapter 7. Gussie Godiva. The sisters Godiva had dwindled to 2. 10 winters had passed since Lulu had wed Drexel. Gussie and Hedwig were still deep in toil, fruitlessly groping for truths in the stables. Hedwig Godiva, placid and hopeful, faced each day with new patience and faith. But Gussie took to thinking too much about love. Repressed, she smoldered with passions galore. Each night she dreamed dreams unbecoming of a maiden. Awaking in anguish, she would light a taper and brood the night through, staring at the portrait of Peeping Sylvester. "Come to me, loved one," his likeness would whisper. "Come to me, sweet, and the hell with your oath." "Dear handsome," she would sigh, "if only I dared." In 1091, just 3 nights before Michaelmas, Gussie gave in to her turbulent urge. She tore up her bedclothes to make an escape rope and lowered herself furtively from her high turret window. It was the night of Peeping Sylvester's birthday. Oath or no oath, she was going to surprise him. As it worked out, however, she surprised only Hedwig, who was a very light sleeper. "You climb," snapped Hedwig, "straight back up those bed sheets. And from now on, young lady, you'll be watched every minute." More frustrated than ever, poor Gussie climbed back. To elude the sharp eye of Hedwig, she realized was impossible. There were no two ways about it. She would have to find a horse truth. She cudgeled her brains as she never had before. Her mind galloped wild along the most amazing thought lanes. By dawn, she had her horse truth. A strange one, perhaps, but entirely legitimate. Hedwig, spying from a wagon, saw Gussie approaching, eyes ablaze. She swept on toward the stables. She clutched a mysterious bundle tight to her breast, hair streaming behind her. Gussie vanished inside. The ancient barn door shut behind her with a slam. For a moment, breathless silence. Hedwig strained hard to hear. Through the walls came the sudden sound of commotion, the crinkle and the crackle of wrapping paper ripping, the uneasy scuffle of a score of nervous hooves, a splashing of liquids, a terrified whinny. The door of the stable burst wide open. Out into the world hurtled Gussie Godiva, clinging to the back of a screaming mad nag, painted forelock to fetlock, a dizzy blue-green. "That," she was shrieking, "is my contribution. That is a horse of another color." As she streaked down the road like a lunatic comet, the giddiest Godiva broke into song. The staid hills of Coventry blushed as they heard her body and raucous and badly off-key. "Hi, diddle-duster, ho, diddle-dum, Peeping Sylvester, here I come." Chapter 8, and the final chapter in this lovely tale. You are listening to Fallen Woman at Radio Free Brooklyn, and I am reading you the story written by Dr. Seuss in 1939, The Seven Lady Godivas. We are to the final Godiva, and this chapter is called Hedwig Godiva. Neither Hedwig nor Peeping Frailyhusen was getting any younger. At 70, he had lost his job teaching harp at the country day school. When his fingers had stiffened, the school board let him go. "Now I can spend my whole time," he wrote Hedwig, "making plans for our marriage." Every warm day the faithful old lover would pack up his basket and trudge with his dog to the top of the hill. There he would lie all day long in the sunshine, gazing far away at the Castle Godiva. Its turrets still rose high, but no longer quite so proudly. Here and there a crumbling battlement had fallen into the moat. The bell in the watchtower was muted with fungus. Everywhere grew blackthorn, sourgrass, and nink. The Castle Godiva was going to pot. With her bed and her bureau, Hedwig had long ago moved into the barn. Each day her situation was growing more critical. Time had been taking its toll in the stables. On December 31st, 1105, she was down to her very last horse. Parsifal! And the poor antique gelding was at death's door with the grip. Yet Without frenzy, without panic, Hedwig attended to the failing steed's needs, dosing him hourly with bowls of hot hippograss, bundling him on the half hour in newly warmed straw. And as the year was dying, Parsifal seemed just a little stronger. Hedwig, for the tonic effect it might have on his spirits, got out her horn and blew the new year in. It was not just a blast that she blew, but a prayer. The hopes of a lifetime went into that horn, and something within Parsifal responded to the call. Hedwig finally went to bed smiling. She had pulled him through his crisis. Parsifal would live. He did live, but Hedwig never saw him again. While she lay deep in the sleep of exhaustion, horse thieves stealthily broke in. An hour before dawn, Hedwig woke with a start. Parsifal's box stall was empty. Her last horse was gone. Any other woman would have dissolved into tears, but Hedwig Godiva was not that kind. From the depths of an impossible situation, she rose to pluck a horse truth out of thin air. "Don't!" she exclaimed as she went out and did it. "Lock the barn door after the horse has been stolen." The stars over Coventry winked as they watched her. With age mellowed, bridal veil crammed in a satchel, she plunged humming through the snowdrifts to the cottage of her ever-patient peeping. You have been listening to Dr. Seuss's The Seven Lady Godivas, read by myself, bedtime story style, Velocity Child, for Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. And now, for a famous short story written by Roald Dahl, the creator of The Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and BFG and James and the Giant Peach. This one is for adults, and it is called Lamb to Slaughter. The room was warm and clean, the curtains drawn, the two table lamps alight, hers and the one by the empty chair opposite. On the sideboard behind her, two tall glasses, soda water, whiskey, fresh ice cubes, in the thermos bucket. Mary Maloney was waiting for her husband to come home from work. Now and again, she would glance up at the clock, but without anxiety, merely to please herself, with the thought that each minute gone by made it nearer the time that he would come. There was a slow, smiling air about her, and about everything she did. The drop of the head as she bent over sewing was curiously tranquil. Her skin, for this was her sixth month with child, had acquired a wonderful translucent quality. The mouth was soft. The eyes, with their new placid look, seemed larger, darker than before. When the clock said 5:10, she began to listen, and a few moments later, punctually as always, she heard the tires on the gravel outside and the car door slamming, the footsteps passing the window, the key turning in the lock. She laid aside her sewing, stood up, and went forward to kiss him as he came in. "Hello, darling," she said. "Hello," he answered. She took his coat and hung it in the closet. Then she walked over and made the drinks, a strongish one for him, a weak one for herself. And she soon was back again in her chair with the sewing, and he in the other opposite, holding the tall glass with both of his hands, rocking it so that the ice cubes tinkled against the side. For her, this was always a blissful time of the day. She knew he didn't want to speak much until the first drink was finished, and she, on her side, was content to sit quietly, enjoying his company after the long hours alone in the house. She loved to luxuriate in the presence of this man, and to feel, almost as a sunbather feels in the sun, that warm male glow that came out of him to her when they were alone together. She loved him for the way he sat loosely in the chair, for the way he came in the door or moved slowly across the room with long strides. She loved the intent, far look in his eyes when they rested on her, the funny shape of his mouth, and especially the way he remained silent about his tiredness, sitting still with himself until the whiskey had taken some of it away. "Tired, darling?" "Yes," he said, "I'm tired." And as he spoke, he did an unusual thing. He lifted his glass and drained it in one swallow, although there was still half of it, at least half of it left. She wasn't really watching him, but she knew what he had done because she had heard the cubes falling back against the bottom of the empty glass when he lowered his arm. He paused a moment, leaning forward in the chair. Then he got up and went slowly over to fetch himself another. "I'll get it," she cried, jumping up. "Sit down," he said. When he came back, she noticed that the new drink was dark amber with a quantity of whiskey in it. Lots and lots of whiskey. "Darling, shall I get your slippers?" "No," he said. She watched him as he began to sip the dark yellow drink, and she could see the little oily swirls in the liquid because it was so strong. "Well, I think it's a shame," she said. "It's just a shame that when a policeman gets to be senior as you, they keep him walking about on his feet all day long." He didn't answer, so she bent her head again and went on with her sewing. But each time he lifted the drink to his lips, she heard the ice cubes clinking against the side of the glass. "Darling," she said, "would you like me to get you some cheese? I haven't made any supper, well, you know, because it's Thursday." "No," he said. "If you're too tired to eat out," she went on, "it's still not too late. There's plenty of meat and stuff in the freezer, and you could have it right here and not even move out of the chair." Her eyes waited on him for an answer, a smile, a little nod, but he made no sign, none at all. "Anyway," she went on, "I'll get you some cheese and crackers first." "I don't want it," he said. She moved uneasily in her chair, the large eyes still watching his face. "But you must have supper. I can easily do it here. I'd like to do it. We can have lamb chops or pork, anything you want. Everything's in the freezer." "Forget it," he said. "But darling, you must eat. I'll fix it anyway. And then you can have it or not, as you like." She stood up, placed her sewing on the table by the lamp. "Sit down," he said. "Just for a minute. Sit down." It wasn't till then that she began to get frightened. "Go on," he said. "Sit down." She lowered herself back slowly into the chair, watching him all the time with those large, bewildered eyes. He had finished the second drink and was staring down into the glass, frowning. "Listen," he said, "I've got something to tell you." "What is it, darling? What's the matter?" He had become absolutely motionless, and he kept his head down so that the light from the lamp beside him fell across the upper part of his face, leaving the chin and the mouth in the shadow. She noticed there was a little muscle moving near the corner of his left eye. "This is going to be a bit of a shock to you, I'm afraid," he said. "But I've thought about it, and it's a good deal. And I've decided the only thing to do is to tell you right away. I hope you won't blame me too much. I have thought about it a good deal. Don't blame me." And he told her. It didn't take long, 4 or 5 minutes at most, and she sat very still throughout it all, watching him with a kind of dazed horror as he went further and further away from her with each word. "So there it is," he added. "And I know it's, well, kind of a bad time to be telling you, but there simply wasn't any other way. Of course I'll give you money and see you're looked after, but there needn't really be any fuss. I hope not, anyway. It wouldn't be very good for my job." Her first instinct was not to believe any of it, to reject it all. It occurred to her that perhaps he just didn't even speak. That she just imagined the whole thing. Maybe if she went about her business and acted as though she hadn't been listening, then later, when she sort of woke up again, she might find none of it had ever happened. "I'll get the supper," she managed to whisper, and this time he didn't stop her. When she walked across the room, she couldn't feel her feet touching the floor. She couldn't feel anything at all except a slight nausea and a desire to vomit. Everything was automatic now. Down the stairs into the cellar, the light switch, the deep freeze, the hand inside the cabinet taking hold of the first object it met. She lifted it out and looked at it. It was wrapped in paper, so she took the paper off and looked at it again. It was a leg of lamb. All right, then, they would have lamb for supper. She carried it upstairs, holding the thin bone end of it with both of her hands, and as she went through the living room, she saw him standing over by the window with his back to her, and she stopped. "For God's sake," he said, hearing her, but not turning around. "Don't make supper for me. I'm going out." At that point, Mary Maloney simply walked up behind him, and without any pause, she swung the big frozen leg of lamb high in the air and brought it down as hard as she could on the back of his head. She might just as well have hit him with a steel club. She stepped back a pace, waiting. The funny thing was, he remained standing there for at least 4 or 5 seconds, gently swaying, and then he crashed to the carpet. The violence of the crash, the noise, the small table overturning, helped bring her out of the shock. She came out slowly, feeling cold and surprised, and she stood for a while blinking at the body, still holding a ridiculous piece of meat tight in both hands. "All right," she told herself. "So I've killed him." It was extraordinary now how clear her mind became all of a sudden. She began thinking very fast. As the wife of a detective, she knew quite well what the penalty would be. That was fine. It made no difference to her. In fact, it would be a relief. On the other hand, what about the child? What were the laws about murderers with unborn children? Did they kill them both? Mother and child? Or did they wait until the 10th month? What did they do? Mary Maloney didn't know, and she certainly wasn't prepared to take a chance. She carried the meat into the kitchen, placed it in the pan, turned the oven on high, and shoved it inside. Then she washed her hands, ran upstairs to the bedroom. She sat down before the mirror, tidied her face, touched up her lips and face. She tried to smile. It came out rather peculiar. She tried again. "Hello, Sam," she said brightly aloud. The voice sounded peculiar, too. "I want some potatoes, please, Sam." "Yes, I think a can of peas." That was better. Both the smile and the voice were coming out better now. She rehearsed it several times more. Then she ran down the stairs, took her coat, went out the back door, down into the garden, into the street. It wasn't 6 o'clock yet, and the lights were still on in the grocery shop. "Hello, Sam," she said, brightly smiling at the man behind the counter. "Why, good evening, Mrs. Maloney. How are you?" "I want some potatoes, please, Sam. Yes, and I think a can of peas." The man turned and reached up behind him on the shelf for the peas. "Patrick's decided he's tired, and, well, he doesn't want to eat out tonight," she told him. "We usually go out Thursdays, you know. And now I don't have any vegetables in the house." "Well, then how about some meat, Mrs. Maloney?" said the grocer. "No, I've got meat. Thank you. I've got a nice leg of lamb from the freezer." "Do you want these potatoes, Mrs. Maloney?" "Oh, yes, they'll be fine. 2 pounds, please." "Anything else?" the grocer said. He looked at her and said, "Hey, how about dessert? What are you going to give him for dessert?" "How about a nice piece of cake? I know he likes cake." "Perfect," she said. "He loves it." And when she had bought and paid for everything, she gave her brightest smile and said, "Thank you, Sam. Good night." And now, she told herself as she hurried back home, she was returning to her husband, and he was waiting for his supper. She had to cook it well and make it taste as good as possible because the poor man was tired. And if she found anything unusual or terrible when she got home, then she would be in shock and she would have to react with grief and horror. Of course, she was not expecting to find anything unusual at home. She was just going home with vegetables on a Thursday evening to cook dinner for her husband. That's why, she told herself, do everything normally. Keep things absolutely natural, and there'll be no need for acting at all. As she entered the kitchen by the back door, she was quietly singing to herself, "Patrick, how are you, darling?" She put the package on the table and went into the living room. And when she saw him lying on the floor, it really was a shock. All the old love for him came back to her, and she ran over to him and knelt down beside him and began to cry hard. It was easy. No acting was necessary at all. A few minutes later, she got up and went to the phone. She knew the number to the precinct. "Who's speaking? Mrs. Maloney, Mrs. Patrick Maloney. Do you mean that Patrick's dead? I think so. He's lying on the floor and I think he's dead. We'll be there immediately." The car came very quickly. When she opened the front door, 2 policemen walked in. She knew them both. "Is he dead?" she cried. "I'm afraid he is." "What happened?" In a few words, she told her story about going to the grocer and coming back and finding him on the floor. While she was crying and talking, Noonan found some dried blood on the dead man's head, and he hurried to the phone. Some other men began to arrive. A doctor, 2 detectives, police photographer, fingerprint man. Detectives kept asking her lots of questions. They always treated her kindly. She told them how she put the meat in the oven. "It's there right now," she said. And how she'd gone to the grocery for vegetables. And how she came back and found him on the floor. The 2 detectives were really nice to her. And they searched the house. Sometimes Mr. Jack Noonan spoke to her gently. He told her that her husband had been killed by a blow to the back of his head. And they were looking for the murder weapon. The murderer might have taken it with him. Who knows? "It's the old story," he said. "Get the weapon and you've got the murderer." Later, one of the detectives sat beside her. "Did she know of anything in the house that could be used as a weapon or be missing?" "No," she said. And the search went on. And it began to get late. And she offered them drinks. And although it wasn't their routine, they knew that they didn't want her to drink alone. They stood around with drinks in their hands. The detectives were uncomfortable with her, and they tried to say consoling things to her. Jack Noonan walked into the kitchen, came out quickly, and said, "Look, Mrs. Maloney, did you know that your oven is still on and that the meat is still inside?" Oh, she said, so it is. I better turn it off. She was saying this with tearful eyes. Would you do me a favor? You're all here, and you're Patrick's friends, and you're trying to catch the man who killed him, and you must be hungry. It's long past your supper time. I know Patrick would never forgive me if I let you stay in the house without offering you anything to eat. Why don't you eat up the lamb in the oven? I wouldn't dream of it, Noonan said. Please, she begged. Personally, I couldn't eat a thing, but it'd be a favor to me if you ate it up. Then you can go on with your work. They hesitated, but they were hungry. And she stayed where she was in the chair and listened to them through the open door. She could hear them speaking among themselves, and their voices were thick because their mouths were full of meat. Have some more, Charlie. No, we better finish it. She wants us to finish it. She said we ought to eat it up. That's a big bar their murderer must have used to hit poor Patrick. The doctor says the back of his head was broken into pieces. The other guy said, that's why the weapon should be easy to find. And then Noonan said, exactly what I say. Whoever did it, he can't carry a weapon that big around with him. Personally, I think the weapon is somewhere near the house. It's probably right under our noses. What do you think? And in the other room, Mary Maloney couldn't help but have a giggle. And that is Lamb to Slaughter by Roald Dahl. Told by Velocity Child, bedtime story style, for Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. You can find archive episodes at www.fallenwoman.com. And thanks again for joining me tonight for this intimate storytelling. Sweet dreams, jelly beans, wherever you are. My name is Velocity Child. Every Thursday at the stroke of midnight, step into the parlor of Fallen Woman, a weekly soiree of artists on the fringe with underground thoughts and voices shared with uncensored abandon through provocative opinions, seductive humor, candor, and song. If you still believe in freedom and haven't totally thrown in the towel this apocalyptic inauguration week, please go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. You can donate as little as a dollar a month to keep independent, censorship-free radio alive and kicking.